Hello and welcome to another episode of the Gaming Moguls Podcast. The only podcast that very clearly understands that was is before is was. I'm your host tonight, Mark Teske, along with my co-host, Mr. Sobi Youssef. Sobi, did you understand at all what I just said?
I don't think I understand any of your intros, Mark. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's one of those that I want somebody to be driving like halfway through the episode and suddenly go, I get it. Funny man.
All right. I will tell you if I get it halfway through the episode.
So before we get into our normal content of what we played and our featured topics and so on and so forth, like usual, we have a massive announcement to do. So actually, I'm going to let the guy who's talked me into doing this do the big reveal. So Sobi, what are we revealing?
I'm drum rolling here. I don't know. You can't hear it. Previously, I'd been planning a yearly what we call muster with our local war game group, the First Minnesota Historical Board Game Society. And Mark actually came last year and brought our friend Nick, and then some of our other friends that we play train games with came as well. So many people there were like, hey, let's do it again this year. And I figured let's combine it with the Gaming Moguls event that Mark and Jake hosted actually 5 years ago now, right, Mark?
That is so hard to believe. So 2019, like 6 months before the world changed, we had Moguls Con 1, and it was just, it was a raving success for everybody who came. It was probably about 40 people. We had a 3-day weekend down in Rosemount, and it's amazing time. And we had huge plans for 2020 to actually double down on that one. We were targeting 100 people. We were just, you know, we were off and running. We were going to do that. Of course, then COVID happened, and now it's been 5 years, and we're finally to a point where it's time to do it again. We're ready to relaunch MogulsCon, try to make it an annual thing, and as promised, we're going bigger.
So the MogulsCon muster this year, it's going to be August 16th through 18th in Hopkins, Minnesota. Mark has this slick site set up. It's gamingmoguls.com/MogulsCon. That's MogulsCon. It's going to be $36 for the full weekend. That's Friday through Sunday. We're gaming about 9:30 a.m. to, let's say, 11, 11:30 Friday and Saturday. And then Sunday is going to let out early, of course. But we're going to have a pretty big gaming library. We're going to have train games, econ, Euro, war games. Like I said, our First Minnesota Historical War Game Society is going to have several people there. So if you're interested, come on down. $36, not half bad.
Yeah, I know for those of you that are listening out of town, that's mighty short notice. And we had planned on announcing this earlier. Having said that, we are probably 2/3 full on our registration. We've been publishing it locally, and we've already got 45-ish people signed up for it. We've got room for about 60. So there's, if you feel like making a trip to Minnesota in the summertime, and trust me, it's lovely here, we would love to host you. And hey, whatever gets it done. Kind of cool part about it is this place is literally 5 minutes from my house. So if there's a game that somebody's missing, we could actually send a runner back to my house to get it. That'll be kind of cool. The other thing we're doing too is we're running this as a very nonprofit type, let's just have fun type organization. So like we're investing back every last dime into this and probably a few of our own. The idea is that, you know, the closer we get to 60, you know, we were adding in pizza parties and we're adding in refreshments and all kinds of other stuff. So you will definitely get your money's worth if you choose to come game with us for the weekend.
So we're already planning games that we want to play, and I'm sure we could talk for a whole episode about just the games we want to play at this event. And maybe that's a good thing for us to record next week or something. But
games we're excited about at MogulsCon.
Yeah.
Market. That'll be our next episode.
Already people are scheduling awesome looking stuff, so I'm super excited.
Yeah, you realize it's only 3 days, and a lot of those games that you like, oh, I totally want to play that at a con, are like, you know, 6 to 8 hours long. So you kind of do the math on that. And there's a limited number of those you can actually do in a weekend. And I don't know. I plan on doing more or less what I did at MogulsCon 1, is try to game with as many different guests as possible. And, you know, if that means I play a bunch of rando kind of smaller things, so be it. You know, I'll certainly try to get a few of mine to the table. I'll do a lot of teaching because that's what I love doing. And if I game with as many people as possible, then it is definitely a successful weekend. And I think I probably hit about 95% of the attendees, 90% of the attendees last time around. And it'll be harder this time, but I'm going to give her the old college try.
That's pretty amazing, Mark. I don't know if I will get even close to that, seeing as 1817 is super high on my list. That will definitely take an entire day of gaming, but we'll see. we'll see if we can get it to the table. There is interest, but man, it's hard. Like you said, it's hard to make that commitment when you have all these friends around and you can play, you know, 10 games in a day instead of one game.
Ongoing challenge, but one I'm looking forward to. So anyway, just to recap, gamingmoguls.com/mogulscon to register, and definitely hope to see you all there. In the meantime, wouldn't be a Moguls episode without diving in and talking about a bunch of games that we've played. We've made a hackneyed attempt at trying to tie some of these together into a theme, and we'll get into that later. But before then, we got together and played some games. Week before last, on a Friday night, out in your screen porch, Sobey, finally got to play one of my very favorite games. And it's a game that I have a difficult time getting my friends to play because it's not a very nice game on all occasions. The game I'm talking about is Barrage, originally designed by Tommaso Battista, Simone Luciani, and published by Cranio Creations. I've played this game a handful of times, and invariably there's somebody that ends up just out in the first round. Sobey, little did I know that would be me this time.
It was definitely you, Mark, but I was a fast follower, I want to say, especially on this Nile Affair map. I was not ready for it. So you weren't alone, that's for sure.
And actually, I said Barrage. It is Barrage. You heard it here first, kids. We looked it up, and apparently in what language actually is that? Do we know?
I think it's I think it's British.
Okay. Don't know.
Oh.
Not a lot of mountains with hydroelectric in Britain. I guess there's a few. Everybody in Britain just screamed and go, "What about Wales? What about Snowdonia?" Yeah, okay. So, Barrage. The core conceit behind this is that you're in kind of an alternate history steampunk 1930s-ish, where you're trying to control water and make hydroelectric power somewhere-ish in Europe-ish, or in this case, Egypt-ish. And the idea is that you've got melting water at the top of the map, it flows down to the bottom of the map, and you only get to score points if you harvest some of that water and turn it into electricity. Now, the very act of doing that actually shunts the water to someplace other than where it was originally flowing, which is a convenient opportunity to completely hose over some of your fellow players.
Good
especially
one.
If you
good
go upriver from them. Hose over. See what I did there? What we decided to do this time is actually give a whirl to the Nile Affair, kind of one of the more recent expansions for Barrage. What it adds to the party is it adds in irrigation. So you actually have an alternative way of making points aside from just making hot power and letting it flow at the bottom. You basically are pulling water completely off the map when you do that. You're spending water, essentially, to get benefits from doing irrigation. And then that water doesn't flow downhill. And if you're irrigating upstream from somebody that's trying to make power, they don't get to make power. And that's bad for them. What did you think of that, Sobey? You've played Barrage a whole bunch of times, and this is your first time playing the Nile Affair, as it was mine. What was your impression of it?
So just to level set, I really like Barrage. I think it's a phenomenal game. I want to say it's reminds me of Gaia Project a little bit, which was probably one of the first heavy Euro games that I absolutely loved. So kind of got me in, you know, off the deep end into heavy games. So Barrage has those vibes. A lot of people say it's got some brass vibes and, you know, some other things, but it really feels like a more interactive but less resource conversion focused Gaia Project.
Sure.
Super, super fun. I really like that. The Nile expansion probably remove some of the things I like from Barrage as a core experience, I guess. And it just kind of adds this like extra mechanism, the irrigation, where it's one of those expansions that's like, you have to do this. You absolutely must do this. But then it doesn't really have a lot of thematic bearing on the game and how it was played previously, right? So that whole progression in Gaia Project, where round by round by round, you have all these goals that you're shooting for and planning for throughout your game. You don't quite have to do that with this Nile expansion. It's a little disappointing, but it was cool to play.
Yeah, I notice it very much turns the prevailing strategy of Barrage on its ear. Because the way the normal map from Barrage is it's pretty cheap to build down low, but it doesn't make much power. The higher you build on the mountain, the more expensive it gets, but the more power it makes. So you kind of work your way up the map as the game goes on in vanilla Barrage. In this one, it sort of disrupts that. And I think that's maybe ostensibly because the Nile is kind of flat. It's not falling down a mountain. So and thematically, it kind of makes sense. So there are good spots at the top of the map, not just at the bottom of the map. So you can do some irrigation. So you know, if people block you out at the bottom of the map to catch all the water and make power, well, you can kind of hose them out by taking the water and spraying it into dirt instead of letting it run downfield, which is also kind of thematic, I guess. I would kind of half couch the comment you made about that you have to do the thing, otherwise you'll lose. Like other things, you don't let somebody else do something by themselves. That's the real theme here. And we let somebody do something all by themselves.
Luke basically won by with like zero enforcement, right? Like he played a great game. He saw I needed to do it, and he just murdered
taking
us.
Taking nothing away from him.
Yeah.
He played a brilliant game, but he did the thing and we did not do the thing. We played Vanilla Barrage and he just ran away with it. Now, had even one more of us have been playing the game with him, it would have balanced the table a lot more.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, I got absolutely rocked. I was in a melting river with some very big fish. Got eaten alive, but that in no way dampened my appreciation for this game. Man, I'm full of it tonight.
That's really good, Mark. I think in general, I'd rather play vanilla. And also the Lee Water expansion is pretty solid too. So I probably prefer to play Lee Water to vanilla, but I'd say both versions are more interesting than Nile Affair to me.
Yeah, I would certainly give Nile Affair another go at it, given that I hadn't played it and we definitely did not play it right. I would like another go at it. I actually have never played Lee Water Project.
Oh, you gotta. It's really good.
Yeah. Anyway, both a approved game from both Sobey and I. It's Barrage by Cranio Creations. Going to call this one a 3D on the Mogul scale. And again, just to recap, the number is how much rules load there is to it. The letter is how much strategy load and, you know, brain thinkiness there is to it on a 1-5 scale and an A through E scale. So 3D means it's kind of a average. It's on par with other Euro games in terms of amount of rules, but it definitely is more brain burny than your average midweight Euro.
I think that's worth applause, by the way, that it's a 3 for the depth of this experience. So
for sure,
that's an awesome accomplishment by this crew. And, you know, Barrage is definitely worthy of playing. So applause. Yeah,
there are many more less substantive games that take way longer to teach.
Yeah, for sure. OK, so after Barrage, Mark, we played some more games because why not play more games when you're sitting on a patio? It's just amazing. And what kind of games do you like to play when you're sitting on a patio, Mark?
Why, Trick Takers, Sobey. I love playing the Trick Taker at the end of the night.
Absolutely. I think Trick Takers are probably the ultimate filler after you finish a game and you have maybe 20 more minutes of people not zombified from just playing a really deep game and it being like 11:30, right? So we got to play a few of them, but I think the most notable that we're going to talk about here is Shut the Books by Taiki Shinzawa, published in Japan by Kentaiki. Now, this is a limited print run. I believe only 100 were printed at all. So very, very hard to find right now. That said, it can be proxied super easily. So if you want to play this, you can definitely play it with any of the normal proxy kits that you're holding on to.
I don't understand that. Okay, I'm going to make a game. It's a slightly abnormal, like, what are the cards? 1-15?
Yeah.
In 4 different suits? Do we really need to make that limited run? I don't get it. At that point, just say, hey, here's a rule book. Buy the rule book. I'm going to make 100 copies of the rule. I don't. That's weird to me, but... whatever. Anyway, go ahead and explain the game.
I'm sorry, but I have to criticize your criticism here, Mark. I have been to your house and I have seen your shelves and shelves of these itty bitty box games. So, you know, while I agree with what you're saying in theory, in practice, neither of us follow this rule.
That's true. What you're obviously referring to is my, well, I have 2 cupboards of really itty bitty box games, one of which is all Oinks and the other, which is lots of other little itty bitty box games. So, yeah, true. But and I certainly have made a point of obtaining some unreasonable to obtain games in the past. So I'm not one to talk. And I can see picking up a copy of Shut the Books in the meantime. So that doesn't mean I don't think it's silly. So anyway, why don't you explain what you do in Shut the Books?
Yeah, absolutely. So Shut the Books is definitely what I call a normal trick-taking game. So there are no crazy hooks here. What you're doing every round, you're going around and bidding on how many tricks you're going to win during the round. And if you hit your bid, you're going to get a certain amount of points. If you miss it by 1, you'll still get some points, not as much. And then from there, it progresses into more and more lost points. You have to be conservative, but you also have to read what's going on with the other bids. So super unique concept here in the fact that it's using such a normal deck and such normal mechanisms and traditional trick-taking mechanisms, but it's just so like smooth, right? So it's so easy to play. You throw down your bid and you just play a nice normal trick-taking game. Now, when you're throwing down a bid, you're putting down any of the cards that you were dealt. So the more bids you make, so let's say I bid, I'm going to win 3 tricks, Mark bids 5. We are only going to play the last full hand. So you have to be really careful here. If someone bids a lot, there are going to be less hands. So less opportunities for people to score. Now, again, if you throw a card down, let's say I put a red 3 down, which in this scenario would be Trump, you're going to have to win a bid with a 3, or you're going to have to win a trick with a 3, or with a red card in order to fulfill that bid. Super simple. If you put down a yellow 4, right, same thing. You can win with a yellow lead or with a 4. Now, the only exception is, of course, with the non-Trump suit cards, you can fulfill that with Trump if you're able to Trump and win. But again, it has to be something that was led with that color or number. So, Mark, can you tell me what you felt about Shut the Books comparatively?
Yeah, I got a couple thoughts to unpack here. So first up, I do like me a trick-taking game, but I have to admit, bidding is something that I didn't play a lot of bidding games growing up. So I don't always understand what to bid, especially it gets really weird when you start talking about some of the lingo around bidding, like I'm going to take 4 Nola or whatever that is. I don't even know what I'm talking about. So that's somewhat new to me. Having said that, it was a little bit challenging for me to look at my hand and go, oh, yeah, I'm totally going to win 4 tricks with this one because, you know, you have to win with either the color or the number. So what's good? I don't know. So I generally played it pretty conservatively. Very fun game, though. I definitely liked it quite a bit. Would you think that this game would be as good if you played it with a standard deck of cards? Not to beat this over the head, but I'm going to beat it over the head, right? I mean, is there anything magical about the 1 through 15? Could you play it, you know, 2 through 13? It's the same game, right?
It's probably calibrated 1 to 15 because of the amount of cards that you would have after the bids happen, right? So I'm sure that they prototyped this with a standard deck of cards, absolutely. And then they found, I really need to add some more because the bids are getting pushed to the bottom and we're not having enough hands, right? So I think there's some development reason why that happens, but I can almost guarantee you that they started testing this with a standard deck of cards.
Thinking out loud, I mean, could this have just been in Hoyle's Book of Games or something like that instead of, you know, issuing it as a separate game? And I'd be interested in actually trying it just with a standard deck of cards and seeing what happens.
That's also a really good testament to how incredible this game is, right? Like, this should really be like in our vocabulary in some capacity. It's just so simple, right? You put a card down and that's, you're going to try to get that, you know?
Yeah, it seems like it should be in Hoyle's Book of Games next to Canasta and Euchre and all of the other things, because it is kind of a pretty elegant, pretty easy to understand system. I mean, a lot of those games our grandparents grew up with and play at the Legion every Saturday night are way woolier than this one.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, That is the perfect term for this game. It is elegant. It is 100% elegant. And I guess we're not going to be rating a lot of these trick-taking games on the Mogul scale necessarily, but just to give everyone an idea of where I'm at on this, if we're to apply like S, A, B, C, D, F ranks to things, I put this as an S-tier trick-taking game. Like, this is top-notch, probably one of the best trick-taking games I've played in the past year.
Yep. Well, go out and get yourself 1 of 100 on those things.
Yeah, good luck.
Speaking of games that would be really, really, really difficult to actually replicate with a standard deck of cards, there's trick-taking games, and then there are trick-taking games that use trick-taking as a mechanism for a bigger game. And you introduced me to one that I honestly thought I was going to hate. I got to be honest with you. I looked at the box, saw GMT on it, and I was like, oh boy, what are we doing here? The game is Barracks Emperor by Ray Farrell and Brad Johnson, published by GMT Games. Shelby, why don't you explain a little bit more about what you're actually doing in Barracks Emperor?
Absolutely. So, like Mark said, this is by Ray Farrell and Brad Johnson, and they both did a game on the same exact topic several years ago called Time of Crisis. Now, Time of Crisis is totally different. It's a deck builder. There's still some area movement and control. But that said, it's a similar concept in that this is about the time of crisis in like the 200s AD, when like there were basically emperors that would serve as emperor of Rome for like 15 minutes and then be murdered by their Praetorian guards, you know. There's just some incredible stories printed on these cards, honestly, about each and every one of these emperors and how they were killed. So I find that to be super interesting. So really, this game is, I want to say, about nothing, because the theme doesn't come through at all. but I really love the idea of, you know, that. Yes. It's like, I'd say, a trick-taking game for military history geeks. Absolutely.
Sure. Yeah, it was a trick-taking game with a board. And part of the game was you won tricks by arranging your cards in a certain position on the board. If you had the highest numbered card around a particular location, you then won that trick and got those points.
The only key point here is that whatever you're playing next to is the technically like leads suit of that trick, supposedly. So let's say your card is next to a blue emperor on one side, on the, let's say, the north side, and then the east side, you're next to a yellow emperor. Well, your card is going to be applied to the blue emperor. If you're a blue card, that's the trump suit, or the lead trick, right? But if you're on the yellow, you're probably not going to win necessarily unless you played this like a special ability or something. It really is war game adjacent, honestly, because you're playing on all these fronts everywhere and you're trying to balance a lot of this like risk of other people winning the emperors that you want to win. So it's really strange. And I think it really took everyone a lot to like wrap our heads around.
Does this make Stratego a trick taker? Just a head to head trick taker. Hey, my six beats your four.
Yeah, two player trick taking game. That's, you know, we should play Stratego next game night. What do you think, Mark?
I actually really like Stratego. I think that game punches way above its weight, honestly.
Yeah.
I think it's actually a fairly serious war game wrapped up in a kid's game. I think of all the kids' games, that one's actually legit a good game.
I am definitely going to play a block war game with you sometime soon. So we have to figure out a time to get something like that played. But there is an entire genre of war games based on Stratego, Mark.
I know, but Stratego is kind of enough for me. I don't know that I need more than Stratego.
Yeah, it is a good game. By the way,
yeah. For as much as I complain about war games and being bad at them and don't understanding them and not liking them and new weird trick-taking games, how did it end up?
I didn't win, definitely. But I know who did win.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Say it. Give it
up. Well done, Mark. Well done. Applause.
Yeah. So I admitted that I thought I was going to hate it, and I ended up really liking it. Some of that might have been the fact that I won. That never hurts. But I actually feel that I won due to specific decisions. I didn't just oops, I won. Like, I was making specific decisions to do things and it worked for me and I won. Now, that might have been aided by the fact that other people didn't really know what the heck they were doing, but we don't need to go down that route.
Yeah. Honestly, though, I think everyone at the table had a good time with this. So I would table this again. It's a good one.
Yeah, I would definitely play that again. Anyway, I'd never heard of it before and quite enjoyed it. So if GMT has one of their sales going on, as they often do, look for Barracks Emperor by Ray Farrell and Brad Johnson. We're actually going to call this a 3B asterisk on the Mogul scale. B because at the end of the day, it was kind of just about having the highest card around a certain area. But at the same time, I think we chatted about it and both agree that there's probably more depth to this when you actually play it over multiple rounds.
Yeah, I think that we did miss the full experience. So it's probably a good practice to do a training round and show people what they're supposed to be doing before that transition, right? And then just go ahead and restart. But of course, only if you have the
time. Well, and honestly, that is probably the way to teach it. Just, you know, okay, now, you know, just set up some scenarios. Okay, just give everybody a certain set of cards and go, okay, now you put this here. Now you put this there. See, you won. Now you take this back here and it counts towards your set.
Yeah, I think the GMT annual sale is actually coming up soon.
There you go. Is this one currently in print?
I believe so, yeah.
Interesting.
Now, there was an announcement, I think, in the most recent P500 update. GMT does an update every month that you know, a lot of us war gamers are really happy to see every time it comes out. It's like a toy circular, right? You know, when you'd get as a kid, you're flipping through and you're like, ah, what's on the GMT update?
It's the Sears Christmas wish book.
Yeah, exactly. But they did have some kind of announcement about a sale coming up. So I'll have to dig into that, but keep your eyes peeled.
There you go. Speaking of games that are definitely not in print, our friend Jerry exposed us to a game here earlier this year that, wow, I had never heard of also. Just random things showing up at my house that I end up really enjoying. Super out of print. Definitely looks like it hasn't been printed since 2012 because it was published in 2010. There you go. This game is Magnum Sol by Marcin Krupinski and Philip Mulinski, published by Leonardo Games. Haven't heard of either one of those fellas nor the publishing company, but Magnum Sol is a delight. It is a pure Euro game with shared incentives. There is an economy in it. There are markets. You don't have to earn the points. You can actually earn points by helping other people earn points. The whole idea is that you're in one of the old salt mines in Poland, and what you try to do is you're taking actions to go down and harvest salt from there. But the problem is that salt actually has to be transported out of the mines over a network of people. And if it's your people, you get it for free. But somebody else's people, they get paid. You got to pay them to do that. So literally, you can just be the guy carrying salt. You don't even have to mine it yourself. The idea is that you collect different types of salt and then fulfill gradually improving contracts in each round. And at the end of the game, it's pure economic game. Whoever has the most money is the winner. And the way that you get more guys is that you go to the employment office and you hire people for money. So late in the game, you got to really look at that and just go, I'm literally spending victory points to get another guy. Am I going to earn 6 points off this extra guy or not? Just tons and tons of cool decisions like that. You know, it's a pretty quick rules teach. Playtime is in hour and change, you know, hour and 15 minutes tops. Man, there's a lot of great stuff going on in that for, you know, what's essentially an hour and a half game and a fairly quick rules teach. And I went out and bought a copy almost immediately after playing it.
Me too. And I didn't play it, but I'm excited too.
There are some probably somewhat rote opening moves the first round. You know, it's one of those where it's probably the first person that has the first turn, probably going to put two guys in the neck of the mine and earn money off of that. And there's, you know, a couple of other kind of rote moves, and they've just had very first round, but there's enough moves in there that I don't think that really warps the game. Like, you're not going to lose the game by not being the first guy. It's just that you have to pivot and do something different because you didn't race to that spot. Or you could put your guys right next to them, and then people have a choice on who they want to move their salt through. Like, a lot of these things, a lot of them are mitigatable. This game is brown as can be. You know, it's as every good 2010 euro is, it's brown on tan on brown on tan and so forth. But I've actually got a number of plays in it since then, and it's actually kind of a surprise we haven't had the opportunity to play it together yet.
Yeah, I do want to play this. You know, looking again, you made the comment a 2010 euro. It's funny if you look it up on BGG, and based on, you know, my friends that enjoy this, the rating 7.0, just that doesn't seem correct at all. Makes me think, like, what game are these people playing?
I know. I don't. It's funny. Like, if you look at the overall rating, it's 2,437th, 1,151 on strategy. I don't understand it. Like, to me, it was really a delight. And just the fact that there was so many different ways of making points, and it was a pure economic euro packed into a pretty short rules teach and a pretty quick playtime. You know, let's look back at 2010. Okay. So anybody that's gotten into games, you know, since things really took off in 2015 or so, would have never heard of this game. Right. So it just doesn't have the juice that Ark Nova had. Nobody's heard of this game. And you look at back in 2010 when this released, what was its competition? Well, the number one game at the time in 2010 was something like Twilight Struggle. I don't know. What was it? It was Agricola. Would it have appealed to the same crowd? I don't know. Did this get a big release? I've never heard of Leonardo Games or these designers before. So I'm assuming this is maybe just law of small numbers, that heavy games people got it, that it didn't stack up versus Twilight Struggle, and then nobody else heard of it and rated it. I don't know. That's my theory on it.
I think you're really getting somewhere with that assessment. I think that this is a time-based rating. So if this kind of game, let's say with like a nicer art, right, were to come out today, I bet you it would get much higher than a 7.
Case in point, Brass Birmingham. You know, let's look at our number one game of all, is a similar-ish type of game. So I think you nailed it. I think if it came out today with better art and better presentation, like 4 expansions. I think this absolutely is a game that would get a lot of buzz.
Yeah, you could have some, like, include some salt shakers with it in the box, like limited edition.
every you know, instead of a meeple, it's a little carve of a guy hauling salt out of there. And oh boy,
such a hilarious theme. Yeah, we can finish this one. I am reading some of the reviews and they're just so funny. Very light. Buy workers, get cubes, sell them at the castle. A fun game to play with your kids once or twice.
I don't disagree with that, but to me, that's a feature, not a bug. It is a very easy game to understand, but winning is a completely different cube of salt, so to speak. It's an economic game, and there's constant economic benefit versus expense kind of calculations you have to be doing. I can do this move. Will I get back and actually get my money back out of it? You have to do that math or you're not going to win. So, yeah, I mean, I actually think that's a testament of a fantastic game when you've got something that is pretty easy to understand yet provides a depth of decision. By the way, one of the coolest things in here is the fact that it has contract fulfillment, but the contract fulfillment is not instantaneous. Basically, you have to make an appointment to fulfill a contract a couple of turns down the road. So you basically have to kind of publicly declare in advance, hey, I'm going to fill this contract. And you can actually do that proactively. Like, you can go reserve a seat in line, even though you may not have the resources for it. It's just one of those things that you have to have them by the time you actually get to the king. And if you don't, you get penalized for it. Now, there's also a cheater power-up that you can get that allows you to basically jump in line and get ahead of people. So you may be in a case where you're like, okay, I'm going to fulfill this contract. I think I have all the stuff. Next turn, I'll have it. By the time I get to the king, good to go. And then somebody jumps in front of you and takes the contract you want. Wonk, wonk.
Oh, it looks like there's an expansion to this game, Mark.
I think I did hear that.
Yeah, Magnum Sol Muria. So it's 2012. You can buy it for the low price of $45 on BGG Marketplace.
That is quite a bit more than I paid for the actual game. I think I bought a copy of the game for $30.
Wow.
So not currently for sale anywhere reasonable that I know of. I found a copy on Board Game Geek Market. Go find a copy. It's great.
So speaking of games that you can't really buy from a store, maybe we can switch over to the other economic side of the spectrum. So train games. So Mark and I have a couple games we're going to talk about here. First, for me, it has to be 1871, The Old Prince. Or I guess it's actually The Old Prince 1871, right, Mark?
This takes place on what island?
This is on Prince Edward Island.
The Island of Misfit Toys.
Is that a thing?
Don't you remember the Christmas movie with the dentist kid who goes to the Island of Misfit Toys and it's all the weird cast off toys that are too strange for anybody to understand?
Man, I wish I grew up in your house, Mark.
Yeah. Everybody else in here knows who the Island of Misfit Toys is. Anyway.
Probably.
The reason I say that, 1871 is a fantastic game centered on the island of Prince Edward Island. I don't think they left any of their ideas out of the box.
Yeah, this is a pretty unique 18XX game. I've played 60 games or 60 matches in the past year, and actually that's almost all of my 18XX experience to this point. So I've kind of fallen off the deep end. That said, none of the games I've played in the past year have grabbed me like The Old Prince. Lucas Boyd did an awesome job. This is rumored to be TBD publishing date by Grand Trunk Games. I guess that's still a rumor. But awesome game. Totally awesome.
What's unique about this one? Let's get right into it.
1871, you are building track on Prince Edward Island. Let's say you want to build track, 2 hexes away. Great. That's awesome. You can do that. But you can't get there in 2 hexes of tile placement unless you have a special private that allows you to place the one single straight track in the entire game. So this... The track laying and operational portion of this game is wild. You're just placing curved track everywhere. There are no straight tracks really until like brown, honestly, the brown phase in this game. So yep. There's a pretty wild operational aspect. Now, that's pretty cool in and of itself, right? And that kind of represents like some thematic issues with Prince Edward Island. another part of that is like the crooked economics of that railroad system in this time period as well. So there's a lot of strange, or I guess not strange, but unique mechanisms for floating companies and starting like the game off in the auction phase from the very beginning. The biggest part of this is the pier, which is Prince Edward Island Railway. And this is a national railroad that you all kind of own shares in. So it's basically a 5-share company that is being paid out based on how many total shares are still in the company through the end of the game. Now, all of the companies outside the first two companies that are typically floated in the beginning are floated by players starting branches of the national railroad, the pier. So this kind of like jostles control of the pier back and forth across all these 5 shares based on who's opening what company. So super unique mechanism, and you know, really changes every game by the way this like drafting type auction is done and how the pier is assembled on a game by game basis. So that really is the most complex mechanism, but don't stop there, Mark. There's more.
Yes, there is.
This wild, you know, national railroad, you also have a player that gets to run the Union Bank. So you have a player that's actively at the timer of the game, if you will, that has an extra investment vehicle underneath of it that can basically like shell its own funds over time, which don't count toward your share limit. You know, really, you have this timer player that is also fighting with you as an active investor at times, too. So really wild interplay of mechanisms here. And every single match of 1871 is entirely unique. There's just always something new. And then this is the first game where I've really learned some of the intricacies of 18XX with like 3-company dumps. So I have to say that this game has everything. This is like kitchen sink. There's so much cool stuff. It all like fits together too really well. Like none of these mechanisms seem like detached or chromey to me after kind of absorbing them. I'm going to be playing this game a lot more. I am not bored of it after playing it probably like 12 times now.
I have probably played it, I don't know, half a dozen times or something like that. The challenge with it is this is a game that has so much going on that you can't just drop in, experience it, and then go away for a while more.
Totally.
There's so much going on with it that I believe that there is essentially player archetypes that have developed. There are roles in the game. And to do well at it or be competitive with other people that are competitive in the game, you have to understand what those roles are and how to play that role and how to defend against the other roles. Did it just become Root? It might have just become Root. This might be Root the 18XX game now that I think about it.
Yeah, that's a good point. It does develop asymmetry, right, through the setup process. So yeah, you could say that it's a Root adjacent. I wouldn't argue with you.
I mean, that is definitely both a plus and a minus. I mean, if this is a game that you're really going to deep dive on and play a lot and understand the archetypes and what other people are doing and how to play them, then there's a very rich, rewarding play experience there for you. Probably wouldn't recommend being a casual participant like I am. You're pretty much just signing up to getting flogged by the people that do understand how to play it. And so therefore, I'm kind of at the point where I've got so many other games I'd rather play than just focusing on this one that I'll jump in and get beat up every once in a while, but I will most likely decline a game of 1871 just because I'm not in it enough to understand what's going on.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's more of, I guess it's not that difficult to absorb from a rules overhead but it does require like study and reps, I think, to be good at it. So I think that that's valid. I did play a game of this recently, most recent game. This was in the tournament that Jerry, our friend Jerry, is running online right now. So there's a 1871 tournament that I want to say it's like 24 players, maybe more. Anyway, I played a match with Freddie Knuckles and JW Geist, but both guys from the from Dome. I think JW Geist is one of the hosts over there. But we had an awesome match. It was over in less than 5 sets, which is pretty short for 1871, but pretty amazing. Set 5 started in green with 4 companies being floated during that stock round, which is crazy for this game. And then ultimately, J.W. Geist had to three-company dump on the like chip loser, right? Like the bottom of the stack, because he was, you know, basically had too much liability in this game. So yeah, it's just crazy how things can happen in 1871 with these stock rounds, right? You have these tranches, you have these companies that you're pulling from the pier, right? Pulling those from the pier's, you know, branches. And then you're starting these new companies. Once you fill a tranche, now you can start more new companies. So we kind of went through this pattern.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, we started like four in one SR. It was just crazy.
The other really wacky thing about this game is the train roster.
Yeah.
It's just got this very granular train roster.
Hex trains and like plus trains. And yeah, there's just so much going on.
Definitely recommended. Kind of the only way to really play it right now, unless you have a friend that print and played it, is to go on 18xx.games. And the implementation there is pretty robust.
Yeah.
So that's 1871, the old prince, or the old prince 1871, I think is the correct way to put it. You'll just see it called top on there. I have also been playing kind of an unusual 18xx game lately that probably has a little extra chrome in it. I have been playing quite a few games of 18SJ, Railways in the Frozen North, a fairly recent release by All Aboard Games, designed by Orjan Wenman. Know a little bit of the backstory on this one. It's one of those that this was kind of a pet project of his, and he developed it out, and it was available for play on 18xx games and then actually got picked up for wider release by All Aboard Games. I think it's done pretty well since then. So the core conceit, it is railroading in Sweden. And there are a lot of interesting parts of railroading in Sweden. For starters, it's an incremental cap game. There are east and west and north-south bonuses in there. So kind of a bit like 1846, where you can go in and get extra bonuses for running long routes. That's always fun. You get extra tile lays if you work to complete the main line, which is fun too. And that actually kind of goes all the way in. So like you can actually contribute a couple of green upgrades. And as long as you're upgrading the main line, you can actually do two green upgrades in one turn, which is pretty neat. Where this gets a little bit crazy is how nationalization occurs. In a lot of 18X games, it's a pretty severe penalty. Like your company gets taken away from you and you get just pennies on the dollar. So you really try to avoid being nationalized. In this game, the penalties aren't really that severe, and it can easily get you out of a tight spot. So the challenge is, though, only one company gets nationalized, and it's the most valuable company that doesn't have a train at the start of a phase. If you have kind of a crap company, you can get rid of it and only lose just a little bit of value on it. The challenge is you have to be the most valuable company when that actually happens. So there's a lot of shenanigans around trying to do that and get yourself positioned so that you can be the one to be nationalized. Most 18SJ players kind of consider it to be a plus to get nationalized away, because you can get rid of your liability with not much penalty. There's also a lengthy and bizarre set of privates on there, some of which are just crazily, they seem to be overpowered, but they're all kind of overpowered. Like, you know, there's one that's just buy a train from the bank at half price anytime during the game. That's always good. There's another one that allows you to buy one kind of early in the round so that you can use it right away.
Are you looting these privates, or are they just giving you special abilities?
Nope, they are lootable too.
Okay.
Lootable and special abilities in there. And there's also a couple of them that kind of work a little bit like, you know, the B&O does in 1830 and so forth, but actually with a little bit more power to them than that. We've played it once the standard way. We also played the full cap variant. Remember, again, there's shenanigans around nationalization. So you could very easily just start companies and try to, you know, for high amounts and try to position them to get nationalized away after you loot them away. Mm-hmm. So I still prefer probably the incremental cap. I would almost always take an incremental cap over a full cap variant just because I think there's more levers to pull. But it definitely made for a more shenanigan-y game by doing it that way. It's called the Oscarian Era, the full capitalization variant. So if you haven't had a chance to play 18SJ yet, Sobi, we need to fire up a game.
Yeah, is this on the most recent AAG wave, or has it been released already?
The most recent one that was delivered.
Oh, it was delivered already?
Like, okay. I have my copy right in front of me here.
Oh, awesome.
I have a physical copy of 18SJ.
Awesome. Yeah, I'd love to try that.
So anyway, that is 18SJ by Orjan Wenman, published by All Aboard Games. That's kind of an A-tier game for me. I like it a lot.
Yeah, I'll definitely give it a shot.
The title of this episode is actually A Tale of Two Sons Worth Its Salt. And I think we're going to talk about an additional son here, too, as kind of a, first impressions that we'll close out the episode with. But I've had the chance to play two different games over the first half of this year that are remarkably similar in terms of theme, yet how they play out and the questions that they ask are crazily different. And just want to explore both of those for a quick minute, and then we'll close you out with the new hotness. How's that sound, Sobi?
This sounds good to me, Mark. So tell me about Soul Last Days of a Star.
A little bit of background. Soul Last Days of a Star is a game where all these planets around the sun have been really good at harvesting the sun for energy. So good, as a matter of fact, that they've destabilized the sun and caused it to go near supernova. And everybody knows that the sun's going to blow up and we got to get out of here. But in order to get out of here, we have to get all of our people onto an arc and get free of the solar system. And to do so, we need a lot of momentum. And to get all that momentum, we have to harvest lots of energy from our sun. But the problem is, every time we do that, we hasten its death. This is a game where you've got motherships orbiting your dying sun. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to launch sun divers out there to create buildings that will harvest energy, transmit it back to your mothership, and then buildings that allow you to transmit that energy out to your arc to give it momentum to escape. Furthermore, you sometimes need to get more sun divers because your sun divers actually assemble themselves into those other buildings. Closer you get into the sun, this basically the board is a giant bunch of orbits around a sun, and your motherships are constantly circling that, and they actually kind of poop out sun divers wherever they go. And so you're constantly kind of rotating around this board. And the basic flow of the game is harvest energy from the sun, get it to your mothership, transmit it out to create momentum. The challenge is the closer you get to the sun, the more powerful these buildings work. So if you've got an energy harvester really close to the sun, it gets lots. If you have an energy transmitter close to the sun, it can transmit lots. And that's great, but it also causes you to draw extra cards. Cards are these things that come in multiple suits that actually are associated with one-shot powers. So there'll be like several different powers per game. And if I get like the blue suit, I can then do the blue power, which might be something like take a sun diver and get an extra momentum for every unique gate that you go through per ring. A lot of really unique powers. So when you do this powerful action, you're also drawing more cards. Well, the problem is that deck of cards has 13 solar flares mixed into it. And the game is done instantly when you draw the 13th solar flare. The sun goes supernova, and only the person that has the most momentum stays alive. And you don't know exactly when that's going to happen. So there's this kind of big rush to just get yourself moving as fast as possible, but that actually kills the game for everyone else. So weirdly, Sobi, I think what I'm trying to say is this is actually Deep Sea Adventure with more steps.
Perfect. I think Sherwin will like to hear that.
That's awesome. I joke about it, but it kind of is, right? Deep Sea Adventure is about diving down deep to get as much reward as possible. And then that actually uses up oxygen and screws other people over. I mean, you're essentially doing the same exact thing in Soul Last Days of a Star.
Yeah, totally. You can really tank the players next to you in this game by playing incorrectly, I feel like. You know, it's got that, exactly has that Deep Sea Adventure vibe, right? Like you can really hurt the other people around you based on what you're doing. So,
right.
I really love this game. I haven't played it in years, so I do need to play it with you guys. But it was a blast. I played this actually at work with some coworkers over the course of several months. And, you know, we'd play this at like a Devani's, you know, having a nice long lunch. But eventually we got a little sick of it. I did sell it. But I do want to play this again. I remember having a blast. It kind of feels like a splatter game, to be honest.
Man, they really did a spectacular job with designing this one, because the other cool thing that I didn't mention is it's shared economies among everybody, because you're not only using your own facility, you can use other people's facility and give them a bonus for doing that. So that's helpful, but you got to be careful you're not helping your opponent too much by using their buildings and helping them out. Again, that's a great feature of the game. I think this checks a lot of amazing boxes. It's a really easy game to teach. The rules are very straightforward. Turn velocity is very high, and that's something that I personally appreciate a lot because I'm a little impatient. Turns actually happen really quickly around the table. It's pretty rare that you ever actually have to sit and wait for somebody to AP about this stuff. And that's really cool. I've also found that actually, games end up going wildly different. Like sometimes you get this huge clump of solar flares that all happen together and the game accelerates just silly fast. also depending on what powers come out. Like if the game that the one that causes you to run Sundivers around through gates for momentum, that game goes down completely different than if you have one that allows you to move your buildings as if they were Sundivers and you basically throw them in the sun for extra momentum. These games have all played out really differently depending on what cards come out in terms of extra powers. So loads and loads of replayability. It plays great at virtually any player count I've discovered, including five. Like even at five players, the turns actually still happen at a pretty quick pace and lots and lots and lots of interactivity because the board gets pretty full. And at the end of the day, doesn't outstay its welcome. I mean, the game ends suddenly. There's no APing the end of the game. It's one of those that if somebody does this gonzo end of the move, it kills it for everybody else quickly. And the game is just boom, done. There's no big scoring point salad thing at the end. You have the most or don't you? Congratulations, you win if you do. It's a game that I have now taught to kind of most of the people in my standard gaming group and has been universally loved.
Yeah, and I want to say briefly, it really says something when you started teaching this game at the same time I started teaching another game I'm going to talk about here the other night. And you guys finished like...
before you were done teaching the rules.
Yeah, like very close. It was like you guys finished 2 hours with teach, I want to say. That's pretty good.
Yeah, and actually we were kind of, we were sort of dinging around a little bit too. It wasn't the most focused 2 hours on planet Earth.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's now available. It was out of print for quite a while and kind of hard to get. It was, I think the first printing of it was a Kickstarter that they didn't make a ton of. And then they tried getting a reprint done during COVID, which then got kind of delayed and was finally delivered 6 months ago, year ago, maybe now. I do believe it's definitely more available now. So certainly something I would highly recommend. I think this is a 3C on the Mogul scale, Sobey. I mean, it's pretty easy to, you know, but I would say it actually maybe trends a little heavier on strategy and trends a little lighter on the rules. So 2.5, C.5. How about that?
Yeah, possibly. I'd put it in that area. I agree.
So the other game I want to compare and contrast that with is another game with a very similar theme. This one's Evacuation by Vladimir Sushi and Suhi, I actually believe it is, and Delicious Games. So again, the idea in Evacuation is that your planet's dying and you got to get everybody out of there and move to a different planet. That theme sound familiar? Yeah.
Never played a game like that before, Mark.
I know. But having said that, these games could not be more different. So the idea with Evacuation is it has this really unique idea that you start the game with a fully functioning economy. You have factories set up, they make stuff, everything's going great. And you have to pick that up and move it lock, stock, and barrel over to another planet and set it back up again. The problem is there's this liminal space in the middle where you don't have anything. You kind of go from having everything to having nothing to starting to have everything again just as the game ends. It's weird in that it doesn't ramp to the end. It kind of contracts and then expands again. It's very strange how the game plays out. You really feel like you're really uprooting, like you're, you know, moving to a refugee camp almost and then trying to get reset up again in your new country. I can't think of another game that works and feels exactly like that. Now, having said that, I think this makes Misery Farm Agricola a positively pleasant play experience. This is excruciatingly painful to play in a good way, right? I mean, I love that, but it hurts. It is so hard to figure out, like, okay, man, I'm giving up everything I have. I'm not going to be able to do anything next turn, but I have to do that in order to get it to the other thing. Because at a certain point in the game, you actually have to start doing stuff in the new world. And if you don't do that stuff in the new world, you actually start actively losing lots of points and it's really bad for you. So there's a lot of really painful decisions and it takes a few games to understand. Like I still don't think I've decoded how to quite do it well yet. Like I can get things set up, I can meet the goals, but every time I play it, I understand it a little more and do a little better. Now you have not played this one yet, right?
Correct. I've played a lot of Suhi games, Suhi. But yep. I have not played this one.
Wouldn't say that this is terribly interactive. Most of the interactions around, like, you know, ships that are up for sale and who gets them first and that sort of thing. But one place where it really does come into play is, you know, there is a limited number of good spots on the new planet. And there is a land rush for those good spots on the new planet. And a bit like terraforming Mars, where there's some benefits to where you set up. there's some things like that going on too, where, you know, it, with advanced play, there's, if you have certain things in a row, you get extra resources and so forth. So there's definitely a fight over getting places first and setting up before someone else does. So anyway, I feel like this is the heaviest of Suhi's games. This is definitely the one that is hardest to understand, most opaque, hardest to get right, hardest to do well in. And I like it. This is a game I will definitely play anytime.
Yeah, he's a good designer. I have a hard time really honestly disliking any of his designs.
This feels so different than every other one of his games. Like, you know, you think about like what a different move from Praga Kaput Regni, right? I mean, Praga Kaput Regni is just like, you know, it's the Oprah Winfrey of Euro games. Everybody gets stuff. You get stuff on every turn. And the way that you do better is getting more stuff than everybody else. If I only get 6 things and everybody else gets 7 things, then I'm doing badly.
It made Phil feel gruntled, right? That was the quote, gruntled.
Yes. This game makes you feel gruntled. Not disgruntled, gruntled. And you feel good in every turn. It's just a Praga Kaput Regni feels so good. And this one just hurts every step of the way. But that's really cool because it's really hard. And it's you honestly feel good when you solve the problem and you're like, I did it. It took me 4 games. I'm up and running on the new planet. That's awesome. That's a real testament to Suhi and his designs that 2 games that didn't come out that many years apart are thematically so different and provide you with such different mental stress. So anyway, there's my tale of 2 suns, one that's blowing up and another planet that's going south. How do you get away and which one feels good and which one doesn't? But they're both recommended. They're both spectacular games. Evacuation's a 3D on the Mogul scale. Not that tough to understand the rules, but getting it right is hard.
The final feature here in this space series, right? Not much to do with the sun, but hey, there are a lot of suns in this setting, is the new hotness. This is Arcs by Cole Worley, published by Leader Games. And this just came out recently, I want to say about a month ago, shipped from Kickstarter. Some other, FLGS are fulfilling it as well. It's shipped with a base game and then a huge box expansion, actually. And the expansion is basically a way to turn that into like a more legacy experience. So talking about Arcs a little bit, this is at its core a trick-taking based game. So I didn't want to say trick-taking because I know a lot of semantic purists will say, oh, you're not taking the actual tricks.
Steven.
But that said, the game has a trick-taking vibe, a significant trick-taking vibe. And a lot of the actions that you're selecting or things that you're trying to do come from that hand management puzzle of the trick-taking core of this game. So in Arcs, what you're doing is every turn you're playing to a trick where someone else or yourself might be leading, and then you are activating cards of different suits that allow you to do different types of actions. So move, attack, build, tax, things like that. So you're trying to gain resources, use those resources to fulfill variable round-by-round contracts, I'll say. So they call them ambitions. And then you're trying to build a tableau out of some of these other cards in the game in order to improve your engine, improve your species and your capabilities. In the game, you have this like warp gate in the middle of the map. And around that, you have all these like sectors of different planets that represent different colors, which are resources. There's some really cool like war game mechanisms here, actually, where, of course, you want to be disrupting people's trade lanes, making it so they can't move through these warp gates very quickly. And then, you know, trying to create more speed bumps rather than like outright, brutal battles, because battling can be completely pointless in this game. So you really want to be careful doing it. You get through the trick taking phase. You might declare some of these like contracts that anyone can fulfill or have the most of a thing on. And then after everyone uses all their cards, everyone passes, the round ends, and then we calculate who gets the points from these ambitions that have been declared. And that happens 5 times or until a player gets 30 points, whatever happens faster. And that is a game of the base edition of Arcs. So you didn't play this, Mark, but like I said earlier, you started teaching Soul to your table, and I started teaching Arcs to my table at the same time. And in a learning game of ARCs, we would not have been able to finish faster than 1 a.m. This is a 8 p.m. start. I want to say 8:30 start.
Yeah, it definitely seemed to be a very, very long game.
Yeah, this was my second play of ARCs. And the first play I played with someone that had played it before several times. And actually, you know, this was my second time. I did do a prototype version a long time ago. And then this most recent time I taught it, probably not the best teacher at this point, since I only played a couple times, but I think the teach was okay. And then we had a couple new players, both with trick-taking experience, by the way. So I think that really helped them grasp the card play quite significantly. But that said, you know, the game is pretty complicated on like how you get this like gear to connect the teeth together, right? It was kind of like clunking together for everyone, that, you know, the first couple rounds. And I think by the time we were ready, you know, ready to call it at the end of the third round, they were starting to get it. So it's a game that's going to take reps, is what I'm saying.
It's like a dice chucker too, right? I saw a whole bunch of dice over there.
Yeah, there are three different types of dice in the game. So, you know, I kind of glossed over all the things that I think Mark would hate about this game because I really want him to play it. But there is area control, which is not significant, honestly, in the game. But there is definitely some feel-bad combat here, and it's reliant on some dice rolls here and there. There are some abilities that will affect the dice, maybe allow you to re-roll some, so on and so forth, as you're progressing through the game. But in general, you have three tiers of dice. You have low-risk dice, you have high-risk dice, and then you have like ground invasion dice. Low-risk dice, you'll never hurt yourself. The high-risk one, high risk, high reward, right? You can lose a lot of ships. And then the orange ground invasion dice basically is going to allow you to destroy these buildings that are in each of the sectors. And this is an interesting mechanism because this causes galactic outrage. So if you destroy someone's like city, then, you know, you basically cause, you know, a war crime, right? This is like an outrage. And then planets of that type will never deal with you again the rest of the game. So there are some resources that, unless you have a special exemption from an ability, you won't be able to use the entire rest of the game if you do this. Super interesting. The reason you would do it is because on this like offering display of special tableau ability cards, if your opponent has any units on those cards, you can seize one of the cards, which is interesting. So now you have all of these trophies or things you've destroyed that now count toward those ambitions or contracts that I talked about. Very deep game. There's a lot to do here. This game is not quite like Root, right? There's more of like a abstract gamey mechanism around it, whereas Root really based on like the GMT coin system in a simplified manner.
Yep.
You know, it's not necessarily like a mechanically complex game, right? You're moving things from point and, you know, taking control of them and so on and so forth, fulfilling some of these requirements. Root is probably more long-term strategic and ARCs is very tactical, which I tend to prefer in games. I'd say that I like ARCs better than Root at this point. It could be because I played Root a lot and this is new, right? But I think I like it better.
So Cole Worley and Later Games are fairly well known for designing very asymmetric games, you know, especially Root being kind of the poster child of that, right? You know, you've got a game where there's different factions. Every faction plays wildly different and you very much have to understand what the other factions do. Is that a thing in ARCs?
Not in the base game, unless you want it to be. So there is like a module that allows you to add asymmetry to the game. That said, you can just get to know the game or you can always ignore the asymmetry. So some of the asymmetry is cool. I'd say actually it's all cool. I had no problems with anything that I saw there. You basically get a leader and then a custom ability and then you pair them together. So there's a lot of different combos. The leader will give you a cool benefit somewhere, but then detriment somewhere else. And then these special abilities all break the game in some small way. So I think that is a cool way to do asymmetry. It's nice that I won't have to teach every single person I ever play with this game every single faction that they could possibly have.
That's a plus for sure. Yep.
So just from that itself, I think ARCs is better for me right now. So I'm excited to play it more.
Sure. It definitely seems like it is the hotness right now. I'm looking at it. It's at like number 600. What is it? Number 640. No, 1306 overall, but it's not in full release yet. I suspect like Roots, this is going to be one that's going to be hard to avoid a year down the road.
Yeah, this will be a top 50 game on BGG, I think, for sure. It already has a lot of buzz around it. People are really enjoying it. Man, I mean, Leader Games went their Discord server. It's like 20,000 people or something, right? So they're really developing communities here around these games. You know, they're not trying to make games that, you know, you play three times, which is really the average people play a new game these days. They're really trying to create communities. They're trying to, you know, get repeat play. And then, of course, they have some of the expansion, you know, economy going on. But really, they're doing the right thing. You're seeing these Kickstarters like far exceed their goals. They're selling a lot of copies and they're getting a lot of great reviews. So can't fault them in any way.
Like if you look at the strategy that they used for round expansions for Root, right? They didn't just add more bells and whistles to Root. They legitimately added new factions that operate completely differently. So, you know, you want more replayability out of Root, just mix up which factions you play with and bam, you got a completely different game. And so, yeah, it's a very smart way to do that.
Yeah, I think a lot of the, I guess, product variation you'll see in this down the road is going to be akin to the, you know, the campaign expansion. Mm-hmm. You know, I was mentioning this earlier, but there's an expansion that allows you to play three games in a row. Or, you know, you can play them at different times. It's easy to pack up and new stuff happens each match, kind of like a legacy type game. So I can see this kind of being their vessel for expansion in the future, right?
Yeah, definitely. I haven't gone and looked recently. I got to believe this has been listed already in the games that we want to play at MogulsCon list, right?
Oh, yeah. People are really interested in getting ARCs to the table. So we'll see it at least a few times over that weekend, I'm sure, and probably will be at least one or two campaigns.
And I think, you know, with that note in mind, that'll be our episode next week is what games do we want to play at MogulCon? So, Sobi, start making your list. Check it twice.
Yeah, that'll be a fun episode to record. I think I did forget to mention the Moguls rating for ARCs. I think it's probably a 3D. And put it in the same category as Barrage. Very deep game. Lots to do and lots to discover. So 3D.
Awesome. Well, yep. I will likely have to give that a whirl at some point. So anyway, that wraps her up for this week. Lots of great discussion. Good to be back. I promise you we will have another episode much more shortly. Again, we want to make sure and get out lots of content and lots more information about the upcoming MogulsCon. GamingMoguls.com/MogulsCon if you'd like to register. And hey, hope to see you there. So for the Gaming Moguls, I'm Mark.
I'm Sobi.
Good night, everybody.
This has been the Gaming Moguls Podcast. Please find us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. Feel free to join our Board Game Geek Guild, Guild number 3431. Find us on Instagram and Twitter, @GamingMoguls. Or reach us via email, jake@GamingMoguls.com or mark@GamingMoguls.com. If you like the Gaming Moguls podcast, please tell a friend. Thanks for listening.